From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Veterans Day 2002 finds one group of veterans following the march toward war with Iraq with unmatched focus and awareness. Almost 700,000 American troops served in the first Gulf War over a decade ago. These men and women know fighting Iraq firsthand. They know the facts and the legends of that Gulf War. They know the skies and deserts that may soon again be battlefields. And they know what we don't know about war this time, about urban combat, perhaps urban combat in Baghdad. Tonight, we've invited Gulf War veterans who served on the front lines and behind them in Operation Desert Storm to join us for an intimate conversation about what it means for America to go back to war with Iraq. If and when it comes, is it right? Is it essential? Or is it a mistake? In this pre-recorded hour, Gulf War veterans speak out about America's next war. Joining me in the studio tonight are Lieutenant Colonel Peggy Bradley. She has 22 years of active duty with the U.S. Army and served with the Army Medical Corps during the Gulf War. Good evening and welcome, Peggy Bradley.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us. Also in the studio tonight, Paul Peroni, who served in the Air Force with the security police in the Gulf War in Riyadh, if I've got that right.
That's correct. Thank you.
With me from Reston, Virginia tonight is Charles Sheehan Miles. He was a private with the Army during Desert Storm, a tank crewman, and has since become a conscientious objector. Good evening and welcome, Charles Sheehan Miles.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. And also with us from McKenzie, Tennessee, is Tracy Smith, an E-4 specialist. He was in Iraq about 30 minutes after the ground war started in the Gulf War in 1992. Good evening and welcome, Tracy Smith.
Good afternoon, sir. Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. We wanted to pull all of you together tonight to talk about your experience in the Gulf War in 1992, to get some of your lasting memories of that war, your insights, your impressions. The learning that you came away with and how you're looking back on that and now looking ahead to the possibility of a new war in this region. President Bush, of course, has said that the highest hope is that Iraq disarms voluntarily and that there is no war. But at the same time, we all know that enormous preparations are underway right now. And with the new UN Security Council resolution, the way has been increasingly cleared for war. Tracy Smith, I wish you'd just kick it off for us and take us back. Tell us exactly what your role was in the Gulf War. Where were you? How did you serve?
Yes, sir, Mr. Ashbrook. I was a member of the 1174th Transportation Company, MTP, of the Tennessee Army National Guard, mm-hmm. and my unit's primary mission was to supply fuel and ammunition to forward support units during the Gulf War. My unit was activated and deployed from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, I believe as did Lieutenant Colonel Bradley's unit. And upon arriving in Saudi Arabia, our unit was dispersed amongst 7th Corps. My platoon was attached to the 101st Forward Support Battalion mm-hmm. of the 1st Infantry Division, supplying fuel and ammunition to 234 Armor.
I understand that you were in Iraq within half an hour of the beginning of the ground war.
Yes, sir. Major shock to everybody within my platoon element.
How did that happen? Were you in Saudi Arabia? Were you in Kuwait when you went into Iraq? Paint that day for us, Tracy Smith, that you went to ground war.
On our departure from the States, we were briefed in air travel that we were going to be setting up a fuel depot and running fuel somewhere south of Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And our mission changed when we hit the ground in Saudi Arabia at Dammam. We were sent out on an early prep team. There were 66 of us about 40 miles south of the neutral zone, which lays between Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Iraq. Mm-hmm. And then we found out that we were going to be, our whole unit was going to be dispersed and different platoon elements attached to different units within the Army. And I was a member of 2nd Platoon of 1174th Trans, and my platoon just happened to be attached to the 101st Forward Support Battalion of the 1st Infantry Division.
And what exactly was that work like, Tracy Smith? What exactly were you doing? I think you were fueling, you were keeping folks supplied, but what did that mean on the ground for people who haven't been in the military, who don't know what that environment looks like?
Well, we have trained for years on setting up these refuel-on-the-go sites, which consist of, if you can imagine, the bladder of a waterbed, but about as big as a a 4,000-square-foot house laying on the ground. And we would run from fueling points within the Saudi Arabia oil refinery areas up to these fuel bladders, fill the bladders up, and then eventually move those bladders forward.
And this was in the desert, and then you'd have long trains of tanks and trucks coming by to be fueled?
Yes, sir. We would move these fuel bladders forward, like one unit would be, or platoon would be, on a fuel run south to pick up new fuel, while we would be moving the fuel forward to refuel the M1 Abrams tanks, trucks with artillery support, and, you know, Hemet's fuel carriers and different equipment of that nature.
Tracy Smith, years ago I used just that kind of fuel bladder in oil exploration. It's dirty work when you get all that diesel fuel floating around, and I can't imagine you had a lot of shower time there.
Well, that's one of the biggest complaints of the men of my platoon was the fact that there was plenty of supplies in the region, but we were unfortunate that we didn't have personnel within our company that would draw those supplies for us. So at one point we were 6 to 8 weeks without a shower or change of clothes. And when you're in that fuel-soaked environment, it gets pretty rough.
Nobody said the war was fun, and that doesn't sound fun.
No, sir.
Lieutenant Colonel Peggy Bradley, you are still active duty military. What was your role during the Gulf War?
I was an administrative officer for the 101st Airborne Division surgeon out of Fort Campbell. And interestingly, I was actually at the time assigned to the hospital there at Fort Campbell. And then many of us are considered what's called PROFIS, professional fillers for the deploying type units. Mm-hmm. And when activity began, obviously, they needed to take some officers like myself. I'm Medical Service Corps, which means I'm in no way a clinician, but I do medical operations activities, administrative, operational planning, that kind of thing, so that the clinicians can do their work. There are positions throughout the division that are not necessarily filled unless it's wartime.
So you were helping administer military or medical readiness in Saudi Arabia. Is that right?
Well, exactly. And actually, before we deployed, one of my big jobs for the division was to fill units with doctors, nurses that are not necessarily assigned to those units in peacetime.
And once you got to the region, you were in northeast Saudi Arabia.
Correct.
Near Kuwait.
King Fahd International Airport. Probably people have seen that on the maps. Mm-hmm. And that's where the 101st headquarters was located. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
We had famously few, though always too many, casualties in that war. I think it was something like 150 American casualties in total.
Yes, sir.
Were you in a location, Peggy Bradley, where you saw wounded coming through, or was it all administration from your vantage point?
Actually, I would make daily trips to all the medical facilities that were there in support of our division. So that was my job, to track people. Personally, I didn't witness that, but what I was exposed to, you know, this was a whole new game for the Army Medical Department.
You know,
years ago, because of communication and technology, you know, years ago, the policy was that if a soldier, like Tracy, for example, let's say he got hurt and he was sent to a division-level hospital, then we would, once it was determined we couldn't get him back to his unit to work again, he would be flown, let's say, to Germany, for example. And then if he was really hurt, we would send him back to the United States. Well, in the old days, that was the last we saw of Tracy. And we kind of, you know, not to be impersonal, but he kind of was erased from our books.
And in the Gulf War?
And in the Gulf War, you know, Tracy, I don't know if you're married or not, but as an example, if his wife could pick up the phone and call Saudi Arabia and say, I understand Tracy's been hurt. Where is he?
And you could track him down.
So my job was to get in a Humvee every day, and I would drive to all the facilities and by name figure out who of the 101st was injured and in those facilities.
We've got it. Paul Peroni, describe your service in the Gulf War for us.
Well, I was in Riyadh, the capital city of Saudi Arabia, as you said earlier, Tom, and that's about 300 miles from the front lines. Mm-hmm. And I was with the 4409 Security Police Squadron. And I was there from September of 1990 to April of 1991. I was active duty Air Force and deployed from Williams Air Force Base in Arizona.
What were you doing? What were you guarding around Riyadh?
My primary my primary mission over there, Tom, was to guard base personnel and property. That's pretty much at
a U.S. base near the Saudi capital.
Right. It was Riyadh. It was a Saudi Arabia base that we were using. Mm-hmm. The United States had contracted with the Saudis to allow us to use it for war purposes.
Right.
And primarily, what we did was we took care of the people coming in and out of the base to make sure that they weren't strapped with bombs, and we checked car trunks. We patrolled the base perimeter.
A concern then, and likely to be even more of a concern in this war, if and when this war comes.
It could be, sure.
Charles Sheehan Miles, your experience. You were a tank crewman.
Yeah, I was with 464 Armor with the 24th Infantry Division, which is they've been redesignated as the 3rd Infantry right now. Mm-hmm. We went up into southern Iraq along the Euphrates River, and then from there moved towards Basra, where we fought in the last battle of the war on March 2nd.
The U.S. tank forces were extremely effective in the Gulf War in overpowering Iraqi tank forces. It's all been painted, the four-day ground war. There's been a great celebration of it in the decades since then. What was the experience like for you, Charles Sheehan Miles, on the ground? Was this the quick, technical, painless war?
I would say no. For me and for some of the people in my unit, I think when we got home, we were very surprised by how it had been portrayed in the media and by what the folks we knew thought about the war, because... Mm-hmm. You know, we did take some casualties. We lost one tank in my company, and we were lucky to not have anyone killed, but we did have a number of people injured in my company and in my battalion, both in friendly fire incidents and in enemy fire. And so it wasn't quite as clean and clear-cut as it appeared. On the other hand, there's no question, we absolutely overwhelmed them in terms of combat power, our ability to hit them in dust storms and at night and from a distance and while we were on the move, just totally outclassed the Iraqis we fought.
After the war, you wrote a novel called Prayer at Rumaila, which gave some pretty tough descriptions of what the war was like on the ground, fictionalized, but drawing on your experience there. And 6 months after your tour of duty, you became a conscientious objector. Why?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I'm not as extreme as I was when I was 20. I guess none of us really are.
Mm-hmm.
But... There was an incident on the February 26th of 91 with my unit. We were up on the Euphrates River Valley on Highway 8, and some trucks came running through our position, actually similar to Tracy's truck, an Iraqi fuel truck, mm-hmm. followed by an Iraqi troop truck. And, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and we'd been up for 3 days, and we were tired, and, someone came rushing through our position, and... the correct thing to do under those circumstances is to open fire, and that's what we did.
This was an Iraqi vehicle.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Although, of course, under the circumstances, that it could have been anyone.
Mm-hmm. But it was coming fast, and the procedure is to open up in that environment.
The fuel truck was hit by a tank round, exploded, and splashed burning diesel fuel all over the other truck, mm-hmm. and. A large number of men came running out, and we shot them. And I'll tell you, this isn't necessarily. I look back on that, and I think it could have just as easily have been a truck bomb, or it could have been, it might well have been bad guys intent on killing us.
Yes.
The people in my unit, and we responded in the militarily correct way, and I don't. Condemn it in terms of anything in those terms. However, the fact is that the human response when you see someone running away on fire is to get a bucket of water, put the fire out.
Not necessarily to shoot.
To wrap them up in a blanket. It's to help them.
Charles Sheehan Miles, hold that thought. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to talk more about the experience of a roundtable of Gulf War veterans joining us on Veterans Day. About their experiences in the deserts of the Middle East, and about their feelings as America prepares for another war against Iraq. We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get into the conversation online by logging on to onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On Veterans Day today, we are talking with four veterans of the Gulf War a decade ago, men and a woman, who were deployed by the U.S. among the nearly 700,000 military who were part of Operation Desert Storm that pushed Iraq out of Kuwait, that did not push Saddam Hussein out of Baghdad. That is an operation that may be upon us soon. And with that in the near potential prospect, we're looking back with these veterans of the Gulf War about their insights and memories of that war and their thoughts about the war that may be ahead of us right now. I'm joined tonight by Tracy Smith in McKenzie, Tennessee. He was an E-4 specialist with the Tennessee National Guard. He was in Iraq about half an hour after the ground war started there. Paul Peroni was now medically retired and a veterans advocate, author of a forthcoming book, Toy Soldier, Sergeant Peroni's Story, was with the Air Force Security Police outside of Riyadh. Charles Sheehan Miles was a private and tank crewman in the Army in the Gulf War. He became a conscientious objector 6 months after his tour of duty there and is author of the novel Prayer at Rumaila. And also with me in the studio is Lieutenant Colonel Peggy Bradley. She was a captain during the Gulf War, was with the 101st Airborne Division, 22 years of active duty service with the U.S. Army. She's a fellow now at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. She was in administrative medical support during the Gulf War. Tracy Smith, we are looking now at a war right in front of us, potentially right back in these same stomping grounds and some to the north, most likely. You, like all Americans, have heard the talk and the threats and the reasons that war is potentially imminent now. What do you think about it? Do you think we should be heading back in?
Well, Tom, my feelings are probably going to be a little bit different from the rest of the panel. As I suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and Gulf War illness, one of the biggest concerns that I have at this time with returning to Iraq is the fact that I feel that we need to make sure that our troops are totally protected, which, you know, I know always you're going to lose troops in battle, more especially the battle we're fixing to go into, because it looks like it is going to be urban combat. But as far as equipment and stuff of that nature, that's my biggest concern at this time. Are we, you know, prepared with our equipment to go into an urban warfare, and is our government doing everything to the best of their ability to, you know, protect our ground troops?
Tracy Smith, let me ask you a couple of things there. First of all, you said that you've had post-traumatic stress syndrome and Gulf War syndrome. What do you mean by those two things?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder in a combat situation is, you know, it's a psychological disability as a result from, you know, things you were seeing and exposed to in the region.
And how does it evidence itself in your life, in your health?
Well, the biggest manifest is generalized social anxiety disorder, a problem with rage, a problem with, you know, all sorts of mental thoughts, and it really isolates you. You become very isolate in your world.
And the Gulf War syndrome aspect of this, Tracy Smith, we've heard a lot about it. It seems to have many different manifestations and some controversy about whether or not it even exists. What's your experience there?
Well, my symptoms with the Gulf War illness is, my worst symptom is neurological. I have several neurological disorders I'm being treated for at this time. And there are all sorts of different studies that have been done. Actually, to date, 242 different studies at a cost of somewhere a little over $300 million spent by the U.S. government.
We should note that at this point, something like 159,000 Gulf War veterans are receiving disability payments from the Department of Veterans Affairs. A considerable number of those, I guess, generally could be described as falling within this category of Gulf War syndrome, which, as I understand, is generally generally attributed to the fear that there was chemical exposure or exposure to vaccinations. Is that that had side effects? Tracy Smith, is that your understanding?
Yes, sir. My main theory on it, from what I have experienced and other Gulf War vets who are sick that I have spoke with. I will state here that my unit was less than 150 personnel, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 70 are being treated at this time for one symptom or another by the Veterans Administration.
So with all that as a background, Tracy Smith, what do you feel about the impending war with Iraq?
Well, you know, Saddam Hussein has been a, you know, evil dictator as long as he's been in power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that goes without saying. He needs to be removed from power. Militarily is the only option because we have been trying to build a regime in his own country to overthrow him since prior to the Gulf War, and that evidently is not going to work unless we get control of ground within his, you know, theater of operation. And as far as, you know, running our troops in there in a full-scale ground war in Baghdad, there's no doubt we can overtake him that way. But there are some other theories on the table, such as special ops, you know, going in, one bullet, take him out, if we can locate him. Because during the Gulf War theater of operation, it was said that he had as many as two dozen, you know, lookalikes mm-hmm. running around. And he always spent his time underground.
So if we could do it with a special ops attack, you'd find that preferable?
Oh, that way more preferable than rolling our armor and infantry in and getting into another situation just as we did in Mogadishu in Somalia in 92.
That's the phrase that comes up among veterans who fear this kind of operation. Paul Peroni, what's your view on the looming war? The right thing to do, the wrong thing to do, or are we ready for it?
Well, it's absolutely the right thing to do, and I think that anybody who sits back and looks at this situation would have to come to the conclusion that the world is not a safer or secure place with Saddam Hussein's regime in it. The problem with going in there with the one-bullet theory and taking out Saddam with one shot is that his regime would still be in power. His son would take over, someone just as crazy, maybe crazier than he is.
Mm.
We have to go in there and completely revamp that government. And we need to set up an interim government and provide security for that government until they can take hold in the country. That's the only way to deal with this problem. I wouldn't even be opposed to setting up a permanent military base inside Iraq where we could keep an eye on Iran while we're there. And this way here, we would cover the Iran threat. We would, and not to get off the subject a little bit, but in North Korea, we're covering them with the bases that we have in South Korea. We'd have the same type of situation in Iraq where we could set up a couple of permanent bases, keep an eye on Iran, take care of the Iraqi situation.
So you're pretty
well.
Gung-ho. You've got to take care of Saddam Hussein. You've got to take care of the regime and the threat.
Well,
go in and even set up an American permanent American military base in South Korea.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't use the term gung-ho because I'm really not a war advocate. But in this situation, I do believe that the world would be a safer place without Saddam Hussein's regime in power, yes.
Yeah, is it Tracy Smith?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Yes, I agree with Mr. Peroni on the issue of going in and setting up a temporary government. Matter of fact, at this time, Sitcom is throwing that around. General Franks has said that, you know, he's ready to go in there mm-hmm. and hold up a government until we can orchestrate, you know, something with the Iraqi people to take over a government with a democracy. I totally agree with that. But as far as, you know, my problem is rolling in, you know, our armor divisions, our infantry divisions, and we're not going to look at 150 casualties this time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to be in the thousands if we go into Baghdad, because at this time, you know, it's public information that Saddam is backing all of his stuff up around the cities to try to protect Baghdad and, you know, the major other infrastructures he has there.
And we're told that there's chemical and biological warfare materials. And that is of course, why President Bush has been pushing to get in there. We're told again to precisely to clean those up. Peggy Bradley, you're active duty. At some point, this new war, when and if it comes, could involve you. How do you feel about it? Is this the right thing? Should we be doing it? Is the U.S. military prepared to do it?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people assume that if you're still wearing the uniform, you know, you're going to have to toe the president's line. But in this case, I absolutely do. I mean, I think today was really good news with the unanimous U.N. resolution
mm-hmm.
approval.
That's the Friday morning.
And mm-hmm. you know, I think the older you get, the bigger the picture is you're able to see. And, you know, I hope people haven't forgotten about 9-1-1 because I personally see a direct correlation.
How do you see that, Peggy Bradley?
Well, I think as... You know, if you learn all the all the investigation that's been going on, try to connect the dots. I think that's an overused term, but, you know, everybody's trying to connect those dots. You know, it just always ends up back in that part of the world.
That part of the world, but there's been a widespread reporting that, in fact, a direct, firm correlation between the 9/11 attacks and Saddam Hussein hasn't been made. Is it the threat of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of this Iraqi leader that makes you decide it's the right thing to go back in?
Well, exactly. I don't think going into Iraq is going in direct retribution for 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like Paul said, it's let's make this world a better place. And I don't think in this day and age it takes a genius to figure out where a big security risk is for all of us.
And what about, in your mind, the fear of urban warfare, the fear of getting bogged down in a country the size of Iraq, in a country where troops, as Tracy Smith points out, are reportedly being drawn in around urban areas, Baghdad in particular? That sounds like a situation that could be much more difficult and thorny than the open desert kind of warfare we saw in Operation Desert Storm.
You know, war's not easy, but, you know, as a person of uniform, I have the utmost confidence in our service. I mean, the training, this is 10, 11, 12 years later, and the training, the equipment, the advancements we've made are phenomenal. We've got the right leadership in place. We've got the right types of units. We've got communication between units that never used to work together, never used to coordinate with each other. They're talking. So I think technologically and militarily, we're the best we've ever been.
That's something that, Tom, if I could interject
Paul
just
Bruni.
One second. I agree with that 100%. The weapons that we had back in 1991 are considered relics today. Okay, we've made leaps and bounds in our technological advances in our weapon system. We won't even use the same weapons that we used in 1991 today. They're so much better today than they were then. They have a new Patriot missile type of a battery now, which will take out a Scud much more effectively than what we had in 1991. I watched personally in Riyadh Scud missiles being chased down to the ground by Patriot missiles. Okay, because the Patriot missile was not effective like we saw.
Of course, we had U.S. military who died from Scud missiles hitting barracks.
That's right. And we had Patriot missiles, like I said, chasing Scud missiles right into buildings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that happened to the Saudi National Defense Building. A Patriot missile slammed right into the side of that building.
Not the most helpful place to catch it.
But our weapons are better now. You know?
Charles Sheehan Miles, give us your view. You came out of the Gulf War pretty skeptical.
Well, I'll tell you, there's two issues here we're talking about, so I'd like to address both of them if I could.
Mm-hmm, please.
One is that all the technology aside, it's still going to be an infantryman on the ground who's going to have to fight this war.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Because of the Baghdad scenario, because of the urban warfare scenario, is that what you're saying?
Well, even in desert warfare, you know, Patriot missiles didn't defeat the Republican Guard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tankers and infantrymen did,
mm-hmm.
and they had to fight it on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And while the technology is an advantage, it's not the end-all and be-all. You have to assume when you go into war that we're going to take casualties. It's a given. Now, that begs the question then, okay, if we're going to take a lot of casualties, is this worth it? Now, there's no question, I think, in anyone's mind that sometimes you have to send our troops into combat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The question is, again, is this particular situation the one that's worth it? I mean, the argument that it'll make the world a safer place, well, I'll tell you, you know, you've got right next door, you've got Syria with just as dangerous a regime. I mean, they've murdered in excess of 20,000 of their own citizens prior to us becoming allies to them in the 1991 Cold War. You know, you're right next door on the other side, you've got Iran with a regime that is definitely not friendly to the United States. Are we planning on potentially invading and occupying all of these countries? One of my big concerns and a question that I hear raised, and the administration I don't think has really answered this properly,
mm-hmm.
if we go in there and overthrow the Iraqi government and occupy this country for 5, 10, 15 years, or however long it takes to, as you put it, reestablish democracy.
Mm. Well, as the Bush administration puts it, I don't know if I do.
Okay,
but,
right. So, the question is that going to increase the resentment against America that already exists in that region? And I think the answer to that is an unqualified yes. It's going to increase the chances of terrorist attacks against the United States, and especially against the troops who are going to be there, because the fact is that the Iraqi people aren't interested in having an American government. Now,
that's this great ambiguous factor here. On the one hand, we've seen an awful lot of reports about all the torture and terror that's been perpetrated by Saddam Hussein's regime, which would lead someone to assume that they want him out of there and would welcome troops that would help them do that. On the other hand, when you're subjected to the onslaught of a foreign army, that's no fun and may not make people totally receptive.
I think one of the big points that people need to be aware of, too, is that I'm not sure that us replacing the government of Iraq necessarily results in a democracy. And that's something that I think all Americans need to be concerned about. If you place a democracy in Iraq, it's not necessarily going to be friendly to the United States. The people that are elected by the Iraqi populace, the majority of whom are Shiite Muslims who sympathize politically with Iran, they're not necessarily going to be friendly to us, especially after we abandoned them after the 91 Gulf War.
And Paul Peroni, I see you putting your hand up here.
Yeah, I have to interject just a little bit here. I think when people talk about casualties of war, I think we really have to remember why people join the military. You know, let's get back to the basics of it. You join the military to serve your country and to go to war. Basically, is what you're not prepared to go to war. You're not going in the military for the educational benefits for the 30 days of paid leave. You're going in there to fight and win wars and to be prepared to do that. And
and yet the country has responded pretty allergically in some wars when the casualties got too high. The Vietnam War, you saw what happened: 50,000 dead, and not much popularity by the end of that war.
Well, one of the things I talk about, Tom, in my book Toy Soldier, is that when the Iraqi war, when the Gulf War started, I went out. I was watching CNN when it started August 2nd. And when I went out into the day room and I talked to some of the airmen in the room, and I said to them, "We're going to be going to the Middle East to protect that oil." And they looked at me dumbfounded, and they didn't believe me. And I said, "Why do you find this so hard to understand? Oil is an interest of the United States, and we're going to protect the interest of the United States. We're going to go over there." They didn't believe that there was ever a chance that they would go to war.
So we've got your perspective, but is there a number of casualties that's too high, even in your view, that we could face? I mean, is there a point at which it's more than anybody signed up for?
I think that there is a point when you have to weigh the balance of what's what price are we willing to pay. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't see why we have to look at the situation and say, "Let's not go because someone might die." You know, if Saddam Hussein comes over here with chemical weapons, or if he gives chemical weapons to Al-Qaeda, hundreds of thousands of Americans could die if he poisons the water or the air. You know, is that a price that's too high to pay to not go? You know, we have to take care of the situation.
If I could interject, Tom.
Charles Sheehan Miles, we just have a couple seconds before the break, but your response?
Sure. Well, part of the premise here, I think, is wrong. I mean, I don't necessarily see any risk that Iraq is going to give chemical weapons to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda would probably use them against Iraq. The regime's that they don't have any common ground at all.
Let's hold it right there for the moment. We're talking with four Gulf War veterans tonight about the prospect of a new war with Iraq, about their experiences in the deserts of the Middle East, about their feelings as America prepares for another war against Iraq. We're not taking calls this hour, but you can get into the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight on Veterans Day with four veterans of the U.S. military forces who served in the Gulf War a decade ago when the United States was at war pushing Iraq out of Kuwait, along with 30 other nations in a grand coalition. My guests tonight are Charles Sheehan Miles. He was a private and tank crewman in the U.S. Army in the Gulf War. Peggy Bradley, lieutenant colonel now and then a captain. Paul Peroni was with the Air Force Security Police in Saudi Arabia for 7 months during the Gulf War. And Tracy Smith, joining us from Tennessee tonight. He was an E-4 specialist with the Tennessee National Guard, fueled a lot of tanks and trucks in the Gulf War a decade ago. Charles Sheehan Miles, I had to interrupt you just before the break there, but you were responding to the issue of casualties.
Well, you have to assume when you go into a military operation there's going to be casualties, because the very nature of war is that it's chaotic and things happen that you don't expect. So if you go in with your measurement already, okay, is this worth it because we're going to take X number of hundreds or potentially thousands of casualties? I think that clarifies the issue, okay?
That's always the calculation, but in the kind of super high stakes manner in which the reasons for this war have been framed. That is, President Bush has said this is a homicidal dictator and tyrant who may be connected to terrorists and who is certainly trying to get his hands on weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. Now, there's a lot that you could go in and question about these things. Some of them clearly beyond much question, others maybe less so. But Charles Sheen Miles, when the president makes that towering case, is it still not enough for you, having been there, having fought in the region?
I think he's making his case based on fear, and that's what I'm hearing over and over and over again. What if September 11th happens again?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, what if September 11th happens to our troops who are over there fighting for something that I don't think the president's made his case? You know, they keep bringing up these really far-out scenarios. You know, Iraq is going to have these remote-control planes that they can fly halfway across the world and drop bombs on us. Where are they getting this stuff? I mean, the weapons inspectors who were there, Scott Ritter, for example, has said clearly that Iraq is largely disarmed, and what we need to do is get the inspectors back in there.
Now, and I guess that's what we're doing right now.
Right.
And I guess clearly the hope at the United Nations is that that will be sufficient. But if Iraq digs in its heels and says, no, we don't want to show you everything, at that point, would you still be willing to live with the risk, Charles Sheen Miles?
I think we'd have to weigh the cost at that point. It certainly would make the case, you know, if you've got a coalition of a large number of countries which are willing to support it, if you've got the backing of the UN, you know, and if in that case it's a little bit different. The big concern is that the rhetoric coming out of the White House has been, you know, we'll go the route of getting approval from Congress and the UN and whatever. But if we don't get any of that stuff, we're going to invade anyway.
That has been the message. Peggy Bradley, I want to put a big issue to you. There is, of course, concern that Iraq will use chemical weapons, biological weapons. They were in evidence in the Gulf War. There was plenty found by inspectors after the Gulf War. One of the fears or complaints that I read from military circles is, or at least the deep concern, that even now U.S. troops are not fully prepared in terms of equipment and training to deal with prolonged battlefield conditions in the presence of chemical or biological warfare agents. Is the U.S. military ready to handle that kind of attack if and when it should come?
Well, I don't want to speak for the entire, you know, all the commanders of the Army about the readiness of their troops, but I will say that you know, Natick, right down the street here, puts a lot of energy into developing new clothing, new mechanisms for immediate treatment if in fact you are exposed. And like I said before, I think we've just come so far with our technology. And, you know, I mean, to this day, those of us still wear the uniform, we spend a lot of time training for that type of incident.
But, has the equipment really changed since the Gulf War? There were complaints about it then.
Yes, it has. It has changed. And I just came out of Fort Knox, Kentucky, which you mentioned urban warfare, and mm-hmm. they have a really outstanding urban warfare training center down there. And that's one of the biggest parts of their training, too, not only the urban warfare itself, but, you know, what they would do if, in fact, they were exposed to NBC or chemical warfare. I think we're trained. I mean, like, I got to agree with the other guys, there's going to be casualties, and mm-hmm. that is a sad and unfortunate circumstance. But as Paul said, you know, we don't come into this profession thinking that we're going to, you know, go 20 years and never see combat. You know, since I've been in, I went to Grenada, and then I did the Desert Storm thing. Of course, they were two totally different mm-hmm. operations. Mm-hmm. But I can just see in that span of just my career, you know, the emphasis on training and being ready, it's a lot better than it was back in the late 70s and early 80s when I first came in. I mean, now we live and breathe readiness. Are we ready? We're training a lot harder. So
Tracy Smith, you must be following this with your experience. There were many sources of potential chemical threat in that war, both Iraqi and otherwise. There's also have been concerns raised about anthrax vaccinations that people received. Of course, if there's a threat, I guess you want to have it. But on the other hand, about anti-chemical warfare agent pills, the PB pills, people have complained about since then.
Yes.
The radioactive armaments that the U.S. uses with its depleted uranium missile tips and even bullets. War is full not only of old-fashioned threats but of newer threats these days. Do you feel that the military is prepared to properly protect its soldiers in that kind of situation?
Tom, I wanted to direct a question to Colonel Bradley and ask her, you know, I fully support my military, I fully support my government, but let's don't hide everything, because in 1999, when we switched over from the 117 gas mask to the M40, there was a test run on 20,000 protective masks, and less than half of them passed the test. So I don't believe that we are totally up to date on our equipment. The gas masks are a great thing. The problem you get into there, people think that, you know, we are able to go over here and wear this equipment for days and days on end. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, when you don your protective mask, your ability to fire a weapon drops 75%. Your accuracy drops 75%. The charcoal suit is good, you know, for somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 weeks. And the biggest problem with the charcoal suit in South, you know, West Asia is the fact that you sweat. And even the Department of Defense has brought that forward last week.
It's a hot environment, and it gets hotter the later things go. Colonel Bradley, you hear the fear, the concern there.
I totally agree with Trey. I mean, I totally agree. And that's, you know, I mean, I'm not a chemical officer, and I'm not a doctor, so I can't speak to either ends. But I would say that, you know, we're doing what we can to prepare for it. I know in the medical arena, you know, we have specific schools for the clinicians to go and learn combat chemical casualty care course down at Fort Sam Houston, and I know that course has been totally revamped. So, you know, if we can't protect ourselves, which there's, I agree, Tracy, I totally understand where you're coming from, but we also have come miles in the arena of care,
yes,
and treatment for,
yes,
for casualties.
Agree.
So you're right. It's a tough situation. God knows it's a tough situation.
Yes, ma'am. And, you know, I do not know what the answer is.
I don't either.
And we have come, like you say, miles and miles since 1991.
You know, in Desert Storm even, we had people come over from Walter Reed and from Fort Sam and actually run these classes while, you know, most of us got over there in August, September of 90. And you know, we didn't spend 4 months just kind of, you know, twiddling our thumbs. All these guys can tell you we were training,
yes,
every
ma'am.
Day. And one of the big things that the medical community worked on was chemical casualty care.
And still, even with that, we have something like 150,000 vets of that war who have complaints, who are on disability. Gulf War syndrome lingers out there as this concern. Chemicals can be a scary thing.
Yes.
Paul Peroni, if it gets into the streets of Baghdad, that's a very different thing from tank warfare in the open desert.
Oh, it is, no doubt.
And very different thing from guarding an airbase in Riyadh.
True.
The enthusiasm that you've got. Well, the guys in Baghdad are going to face a different situation than you did personally in the Gulf War.
That's true. They will. But they have to remember, too, that they're being trained for this situation. They joined the military for this situation. I'm not saying that I like it. They shouldn't like it. They should go in prepared. As I said before, my life, Tom, was turned upside down and sideways by this war. I'm 100% disabled with multiple sclerosis as a direct result of this war.
From some chemical contamination,
from,
you believe?
From the anthrax vaccine. I believe the anthrax vaccine I received in January of 1991 triggered an autoimmune response in me and thousands of other veterans.
We've got.
I agree with you, Paul.
Tracy and Paul and all of my guests tonight, with that, our time has come to an end. I want to thank you for sharing your memories of that war, your thoughts about this war. For a Veterans Day audience that I'm sure is listening closely. These are difficult, difficult trade-offs. Thank you for your perspectives. Thank you to you, Lieutenant Colonel Peggy Bradley, 22 years in the U.S. Army, now a fellow at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Charles Sheehan Miles in Reston, Virginia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Charles Sheehan Miles is author of the novel Prayer at Ramila. Paul Peroni, here in the studio.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. And Tracy Smith in McKenzie, Tennessee, thanks for being with us.
Yes, Tom, thank you. And I'd like to say thank you to the rest of the participants and wish them all a very happy Veterans Day.
Thank you.
Same to you.
Thanks to you all. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, poet Alice Barton with her reflections on Veterans Day. This is On Point. November 11th, 1918, during the 11th minute of the 11th hour, a ceasefire was signed that ended World War I. As Kurt Vonnegut once wrote, it was during that moment that millions upon millions of human beings stopped butchering one another. In memory of those who died, November 11th became the solemn holiday Armistice Day, now known as Veterans Day. Cape Cod poet Alice Barton's father, Edward, served in France during World War I. 4 years ago today, a discussion of Veterans Day inspired her to write a poetic tribute to her dad. Here is Alice Barton reading her poem, Armistice.
Dad, it is November 11, 1998. Your war has been over for 80 years, but tonight I am thinking about you. Tonight I am thinking about you, a splendid boy proud in his new uniform, a boy child unable to know whether farewell to dog or mother hurts most, a terrified boy in a trench, fighting off rats, picking off lice, shooting at other boys, a choking boy, tearing at his gas mask, a lonely boy alone in a foreign hospital. Tonight I am thinking of you as young father, proud in a Legion uniform, holding the hand of his young daughter, also in Legion uniform. An upright soldier marching in parades, observing the silence of the 11th minute, of the 11th hour, of the 11th day, of the 11th month. A young father, crying as he looks at a picture of himself, the boy, man, soldier. Tonight I am thinking of you as eloquent man who spoke on every subject but war and death. A terrifying man of stormy moods and odd retreats, keeping for days in a darkened room, emerging finally in frenzies of rage or joy. A man who cursed his sons who did not go to war to become real men. A wheezing, coughing man who carried war in his heart and made our home a battlefield I did not understand. Tonight, I am thinking about you as terminal patient in the Veterans Hospital on the Hill. An old man, too young to die, too young to have killed. My father, my life-hungry father, with terror in his eyes, war in his heart and lungs, killed at last by poison gas and memory. Tonight, I am thinking of you, my sickly father, coughing up clots of poison.
Cape Cod poet Alice Barton reading her poem, Armistice. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.